This is part two with Tim Richardson, a garden writer, historian, and so many other titles after his name. If you haven't heard part one, go back, not last week, but the week before, because if you don't, this part will make no sense at all to you. Ladies and gentlemen, you're very welcome to another episode of the Sideshow Garden Podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sideshow Garden Podcast.
Personal questions. This is another chapter in the book. I could literally go through the whole thing and recite these back to you all day, to be quite fair, you listening at home and Tim. But of personal questions, December 2006. I'm only on page 16, as a by the way, for you listening at home. However, the second question that I apparently shouldn't ask you, but you do know that one is of how did you get into gardening? We've covered that one. And the second one is people often expect garden designers and writers to have wonderful gardens, which somehow epitomize their own signature style. Pause. When people ask what my own garden is like, my stock response is a disgrace. When we're talking about people being critical of others or being a garden critic, to better word that, that you make yourself one of your own, may I call it, jokes, warmed me to you slightly. It almost made you a little bit Irish of genetics in that you can't take compliments very well.
That is high praise indeed. Thank you very much. I realise the level of praise I'm getting. Thank you very much. Well, yeah, I mean, I do sort of take that slightly rhetorical position. Of course, the horrible truth is I do gardening, and I do go in the garden and work in the garden and have made interesting gardens myself. But the point is as a critic, I think in our discipline, if we want our discipline of garden and landscape making and design to be taken more seriously and to be up there in the hierarchy of the arts, with of course the other, but also with the fine arts, if you like, then, you know, we need a critical discourse and a discipline. And critics of art and architecture and music and painting are never asked, oh, what's your own painting like? Do you compose yourself? You know, you ask the architect, oh, how good are you at building walls? You know, so my point is that as a garden and landscape critic, we shouldn't really be asking that kind of a question, because by asking it, we're actually denigrating the world in which we're working of gardens and landscape, because our attitude towards it is it's some sort of a hobby, or it's only something which can be done or can be commented upon by those who are doers and makers. So that's the sort of that's the kind of a stance I take, I suppose. And I remember when I was, you know, not all that long ago, really, it was only about 15 years ago, another garden writer, a famous garden journalist, came up to me, I didn't know this person, and said to me, you cannot write about gardens unless you have made a serious, impressive garden of your own, like this. And I basically said back, well, look, no, I don't agree. You know, in fact, it's, you know, arguably it's better that if you haven't made a serious garden of your own. You know, if you're going to be a critic, it's more important to have a historical understanding of gardens and landscape, and also an international one. You know, so I've always made the point of writing books about the international scene, and written books all around the world. At the moment, I'm researching a book on the gardens of ancient Korea, for example. You know, so this sort of thing is quite a long way away from making a pastiche of Sissinghurst in a Surrey garden.
Tim, why did you decide to set up Chelsea Fringe?
Well, that was really because I noticed, I suppose, about 10 years ago, that there was all of this community gardening and gardening going on, and I started to do a few articles and meet some of the people who were doing it. I'm not a community gardener or a guerrilla gardener, but I was really amazed at what they were doing and very intrigued and kind of quite energized by it and excited by it and admired them a lot. And because what they do, they're volunteers, and it's extremely selfless. You know, they're making their own gardens and other gardens in the vicinity, or doing little plantings around and about, which are improving, usually in cities, improving the lives of their neighbours, and they're kind of getting to know their neighbours, and it's a fantastic way of creating what the politicians call social cohesion, but the rest of us call just sort of making friends, really, through gardening. So, you know, because of that, I realised that I felt that there was something in the air, and I wanted to find a way of really celebrating it. It didn't seem to be being celebrated by the mainstream. So I just sort of woke up. It was in Chelsea Flower Show Week, and I've been doing these events at the Garden Museum for a number of years. And I woke up at about 5 a.m., just lying in bed, and I was thinking, yeah, we should have a sort of Salon des Refusés exhibition of things that can't get into Chelsea Flower Show and expand the events that we were doing in Chelsea Week at the Garden Museum and maybe have an exhibition or something. And then had this idea for the Fringe Festival, of course, on the Edinburgh Fringe. And it sort of came fully formed there as I lay in my bed at 5 in the morning. And that fully formed idea hasn't changed at all. You know, we've had 7 Chelsea Fringes now. Had something like 1,600 different events in that, and all over the world, in fact, in different countries, mostly based in London, but all over the place. And, you know, I've really enjoyed doing it. And it's very important that Fringe is unsponsored and unfunded. So it's really run by volunteers, and we exist on the registration fees that people pay. But, you know, you can sense that I'm quite an independent-minded person, and I like things to be independent. And this is definitely independent of all civic patronage, government, independent of corporates, independent of the art scene and the whole kind of funding round with the Art Council and all the rest of it. We don't ask for that money. In fact, they can be very, very disarmed when I go and speak to some of these bodies or philanthropic people and charities who do funding. And I say to them, actually, we don't want any of your money. And I've come here to offer you something, you know, and I think that's extremely powerful. And it can only exist because of the internet, this, you know, because we can run this as an umbrella or a platform for all of these events using an internet platform and disseminate it in that way.
Let me put that entire question in context. And I do love the fact that you have said, look, I don't want your money, because invariably what I have seen with gardening events, people who, shall we say it, sing from the heart. I'll take London College of Garden Design and I'll take CD Natural Stone. CD Natural Stone, for you listening at home, and London College of Garden Design both came to me and said, Peter, we'd like to help you to record some episodes of The Sideshow because I won't take money from listeners. I refuse point blank to take money from listeners. Mm. When we did a Two Spots Coffee giveaway, I refused to do a retweet and win because that irates me. It slightly annoys me. It's up there with Cliff Richard's greatest hits or Shania Twain's music or whoever else gets on your nerves. I don't know.
We're having a kind of informal competition for who can be the most self-righteous here, aren't we, Peter, me and you, with this?
Well, none of my books have been published, Tim, so you win on every single level.
We also really, we must make the point that, you know, I love doing the Chelsea Fringe. I get a huge amount out of it, and obviously you do, don't you, from doing your podcast. So it's not some sort of altruistic endeavour, is it, really? I mean, it's sort of partly that, I imagine, but, you know, I mean, of course, everyone does this sort of thing for the, you know, there's amazing benefits to be had from it, which aren't necessarily in the bank.
That is exactly where I was heading with it, Tim. The greatest question that I'm asked is, what do you get out of the Sideshow? And the answer is 99.9% of the time, absolutely nothing. And when I mentioned CD and Two Spots Coffee, who produced 50 mugs and posted them literally all over the world, people were asking me, how do I get one? And I said, you have to be absolutely amazing. They said, well, how do I become absolutely amazing? And I said, well, I don't know, ask your mother. And in both sponsor, inverted commas, Kate, it was that they didn't want to do anything, they just wanted to help me out. In reality, I needed money to get to Chelsea to stay overnight and to buy a new microphone. And in London College of Garden Design's case, it was something entirely similar. However, to Chelsea Fringe or to fringes or to events as such, what I tend to find is that the money does come in, and then the remit changes, and then all of a sudden it's rebranded, and all of a sudden it was never what it was intended to be in the first place. And essentially the people who were there at the very bottom when it all kicked off, who wore their heart on their sleeve, tend to fall away.
Yeah, that can happen. It can corrupt the money and funding. I think my main reason, though, isn't exactly that. I'm pretty corrupt. I feel I'm corrupted already, you know, by the world. But no, my main reason for not seeking sponsorship is that I fear that once that sponsorship goes, the whole thing will collapse. And I think I've seen other initiatives where sponsors will typically hang around for maybe 2 to 4 years, and maybe a bit longer if you're very lucky. But usually they usually stick around for about 3 years. And if you receive substantial funding for something like a festival, you become within that period completely used to having that money and employing people. And if the sponsor goes and you don't manage to find another one, And with something like the Chelsea Fringe, that certainly would be a possibility because it's a smallish event. It's a bit left field and so on. Then my worry would be that the whole thing would collapse. You know, we've set up this structure which can't be sustained. So that's my main reason, actually. It's not just the money.
Tim, I want to go to just on your book, because when I read it and I couldn't put it down, I wanted to see if it was just me, one. And two, I wanted to see if you had a track record of being pretty amazing at everything you seem to touch. I went online to read some reviews of your book. I found one-star review I only found one. The review was that you were essentially amazing. And I said, was saying in my head, why did he give it one star? And I've come to the conclusion that he pressed the wrong button. That's all I could come up with.
Yeah.
I can't find anything negative about you. And what actually came to my head was Spike Milligan. I'll see if we can play this for you listening at home just now.
Spike, I'm sure everyone knows that you have fans from all walks of life. And of course, there's one very, very famous, very well-respected fan in particular who wanted to be here, couldn't be here, but wanted to send a message.
These are a series of clichés you've
made. That's my job this evening. Here we go. I have a letter to read out here from His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales.
Do I kneel down for this?
I'm in enough trouble already. I'm not going to say a word.
And the Prince of Wales?
The Prince of Wales. I'm sorry I have to do this, but I know it takes a lot of impact out of it, but here we go. As someone who grew up to the sounds of the Goon Show on the steam-driven wireless, I must confess that I've been a lifelong fan of the participants in the show, and particularly of Spike Milligan.
Oh, the little grovelling bastard.
How do I say it? I don't mean to suggest that you insult people. I'll stick with the Spike Milligan thing. But when you are a critic of, I expected that somebody maybe would have come back and said, well, I was irate when I read Tim's latest thing, or I disagree with how he said this, this, and this. But essentially, I just transpires that everybody seems to adore you. Full stop.
Well, no, that isn't the case. I mean, I do hear on the grapevine that people are, quote, you know, very upset about things I've written. Usually at Chelsea time, if I've made some sort of comments, some funny, I think, comments or been a bit sarcastic perhaps about people's work, then, you know, people, I hear on the grapevine that people are upset. And I will normally go and actually talk to them about it and just sort of try to make friends again with them, really. And usually they sort of calm down. I mean, Chelsea can be a little bit of a bubble, as you know, and you know, all of the emotions are heightened. I got into trouble with the, there's one column in there, because a lot of the work in this book is from a column I wrote in a magazine called Garden Design Journal, which is the house magazine of the Society of Garden Designers. And in fact, it was the realization that all of those columns only were read by quite a small audience of perhaps a couple of thousand. And I did it for 10 years every month, this column. And it's probably the most, the work I've had the best sort of feedback about, if you like, over the years. So I wanted to find a vehicle for kind of putting a number of them out there. And that's what this book is. As I said, I did write for them for 10 years, but eventually I got sacked by the Society of Garden Designers Journal because I wrote a column taking the mickey out of their... I was sort of biting the hand that fed, obviously, but there's a great tradition of that, you know, of course. You know, you despise your own patron always. But, you know, I attacked the Society of Garden Designers' own awards, which they just launched, because I'd really noticed that in the awards, the first awards ceremony they had, there were no top flight designers had taken part. And in fact, all the awards seemed to be going to committee members of the Society, of, you know, who are good designers, a lot of them, but they're not the Dan Pearsons, the Tom Stewart Smiths, etc. of this world. And I also really dislike awards generally. I actually hate awards. So I kind of have a bit of a problem myself anyway with the concept of them. I don't like them. But I thought this set of awards particularly was a little bit weird, you know, and I wrote this column in which I named the committee member who had actually organized the awards and sponsored them and then won the major award himself. My favorite moment was when so-and-so won the award sponsored by so-and-so, and it was presented by so-and-so to so-and-so. It was all his name, and I actually sent it to him just to say, look, I've written this and it's only a joke, but I was sacked. immediately afterwards by email. So I do laugh about it, but I just wanted them to know. I wanted them to know that it had been noticed. And so it was a sort of act of harakiri. I knew that I might be sacked as a result of it, but I'd slightly lost respect for the institution at that point. So, it doesn't all go kind of smoothly. That's an example. And I lost my income. You know, I'm a freelance journalist. I lost income as a result of this display. But I thought the honest thing to do would be to send it directly. Who could have quietly just sort of shunted it aside, but decided not to, and to get me out.
Got my mom ringing in my ears, Tim. I had this in conversation with James Basson. She had two cliches. She had a cliche for every single day and every event of the day, to be quite fair to her. But one was, could you not just be like your brother Liam?
Yeah, why can't you? I was thinking that. Yeah. He's really nice.
Well, Liam is pretty amazing to his credit. However, the other one was essentially to always stand up for what you believe in until the point that I stood up for what I believed in which case I ended up getting into trouble. And I will reference gardens that I have made in the past where I maybe declined to accept medal because the objective wasn't to win medal. The objective was to complete the garden. And so I ended up in the gardening world, sometimes it's never really that controversial. But at the same token, I can appreciate why when phone calls went to my mom, she may have said, what's he done now? Except at this stage of the game, I was 30 or 40 years of age and not 6 or 7 in long trousers to differentiate. Do you wear your heart in your sleeve, Tim? And I'll bite you stand by that. In this case, it seems to have, can I call it, got you into trouble, but does it continue through your life? But an admirable trait, I should say.
I knew what I was doing. I knew what I was doing. It was deliberate. You know, I didn't get into trouble usually by accident. And as I say, I write very carefully. You know, I spend a lot of time on the work and I take it extremely seriously. It's all I do. And I'm very, very careful when I write exactly how I put things as well. And as I say, I do, if I get it wrong, and I have had this one occasion where I felt I got it wrong, and I wrote and apologized to the designer concerned because I'd just gone a bit, hadn't been fair with what I'd said. So, but that's a nice, you know, it's quite unusual. So if I get in trouble, it's usually I can predict it. I mean, funnily enough, I got into trouble also with one of the articles which you quoted at the very beginning, the first article in this book about Sissinghurst, because I said, you know, as you quoted, that the reason I was saying that was because the garden felt to me inauthentic because it bore that at that time, it doesn't anymore, but it bore at that time little relation to the garden created by Vita Sackville-West, a very romantic garden with the roses going everywhere and a really unruly feel to it if you look at contemporary photographs, the descriptions. Whereas Sissinghurst had become a very, very good garden, a very, very good horticultural garden by the 1990s and the 2000s. But it was sort of gardened in an exemplary fashion, if you like, by the National Trust, but in quite a sort of rigorous fashion. And I just felt that it had a little to do with Vita would not have liked. So I wrote this, and to my amazement, in fact, an ex-employee of the National Trust, a high-up person, at this point I was on the gardens panel, wrote it, demanding my director general, demanding my immediate removal from this committee for saying this. And I just was amazed. I mean, this is somebody I looked upon as a friend, actually, and the chair of the head of gardens and the chair of the panel and so sort of defended me. And in fact, subsequently put into place precisely the recommendations I'd made, even down to inviting Dan Pearson to come along as an informal gardens advisor at Sissinghurst, which he is now. And with Troy Scott-Smith in post as a great head gardener there, it's very much got that, getting that romantic feel back again. So in that sense, I was vindicated, but I was surprised I was completely amazed, actually, to have got this. So that's the most discombobulating thing, and it hasn't happened, think of another one, but that was when it happened that I wrote something and it had consequences I hadn't intended or predicted.
For those of you listening at home, Dan Pearson, whilst we join a few dots, designed the courtyard garden at the Garden Museum in Lambeth in London. How do I phrase this to you, Tim? Would you be a fan of Dan's and the things that he does. And to his credit, that garden, and as Christopher spoke to me, the fact that they tied the architecture in with the landscape design at the same time. But for you architects listening out there, please take a leaf from it. And if you go and see it, you'll understand why the two appear in unison. As a fan of his, are you and do you therefore critique his work and his gardens? And if you do, is that, how do I phrase it? I know one garden writer who critiqued me heavily, and we had a pint of Guinness that evening, and we were laughing about it, and I was saying it was the best thing you could have ever done for my business.
Yeah, well, different people react to criticism in different ways, and I do, of course, I know Dan, and I've known him for a long time now, and all of the leading designers, I guess, to varying degrees, I know them, and some of them, you know, I count as friends. But even the people who are, I would count as friends, I sometimes say it to them explicitly, you know, when I'm writing, that has no impact on it. And I might write something, I'm going to see someone tomorrow who's actually an artist, is also a friend, to see his latest collection of work. And I actually said this to him, you know, I'm a critic, so I might come along and it might not be exactly what you want to hear necessarily. But that's what I do, and they like it. But it's also certainly not the end of the world if someone makes a comment about your work. So, yes, I do know, and I would never describe myself as a fan exactly, but I certainly have feel very enthusiastic about certain things that he's done in the past, much of his work. I mean, funnily enough, I'm less of a fan of the courtyard garden at the Darwin Museum. It's more, I'm less of a fan of the shape of the garden, which I'm not sure that was to Dan. I don't think it's a big enough space there to really be able to function. And also it doesn't properly take account of the extraordinary tombs which are in the garden. It's an ex-graveyard. The Tradescants, and it's just quite extraordinary.
For those of you listening at home, Tim's line is a little bit coming and going, and I apologise for that. It is one of those things that invariably just happens. But the last point that you made, Tim, was on a gushing of praise for Chelsea Gardens and all things that are essentially amazing. I'll go back and say what I said recently in conversation and in part one of our chat, which was what evolved from Helen and James Basson's garden in 2017 and then it being pitted against somebody who we have also mentioned, Chris Birchall's garden. The slight case of the Emperor's New Clothes that may evolve with anything that's created at Chelsea, where it invariably has to be amazing because it's at Chelsea.
Yeah, well, it can be. I mean, I don't know about the New Clothes. I think sometimes just gardens and designs don't work in the way that they're intended to. And I have great sympathy actually with the designers at these shows, because I think it's almost impossible to make a good garden design at them. In fact, I can think of only two, three gardens at Chelsea Flower Show that I've ever seen that I think were any good, really, in and of themselves, because I think the spaces that the designers are given, the rule book which they're given, and then the demands of the sponsors all conspire to make it a really, really hard thing to achieve. And many of these gardens have got far too much structure in them. Nearly all the sculptures which are included in these gardens are terrible, frankly. Many of the buildings which are put in are cliched and have no architectural merit. I mean, the good thing about Chelsea Flower Show is planting design. You know, that is what I think we get Chelsea and other British shows like Hampton to see, the very best planting design in the world. And sometimes I feel that it would be better if these designers could just really be given a means of expressing themselves. That is where landscape garden design does still lead the world, I think, is in this genre of planting design, which actually has been recognised in places like America, really, in the mainstream in America and the landscape profession there. They, you know, they take Russell Page's view that the sebaceous borders are only so much multicolored hay, as he put them, they're sort of fripperies, and that the real work is in the kind of the hard design. So I kind of have, while I'm a bit harsh, I take this sort of slightly wry and comical kind of view of a lot of these gardens. I'm not saying that the designers who are making them in most cases, it's just that the brief given is impossible to fulfil.
On that subject, what are the three gardens at Chelsea that you had a great love for?
It was a garden designed by Rupert Golby when I worked at Country Life magazine. So I have done a Chelsea garden, and I do know what it means, and all a huge amount of hard work and all the rest of it involved with making it. But this garden by Christopher Bradley Hole happened to be in the neighbouring plot, and it won the best in show in Chelsea, and R1 won a gold. And but it was quite right that Christopher Bradley Hole's did win, because it was a really groundbreaking design. It was the so-called Virgilian garden, where he used big irises and lots of grasses and this very modernist kind of extracted geometric design with interesting vistas all the way along it. And it was truly groundbreaking, actually, even more so than what John Brooks, well, as much so as John Brooks's Chelsea garden designs in the early 1960s. We hadn't really seen anything like it. And I think that he single-handedly rehabilitated modernism in a garden setting into the British garden scene, and also played a strong in introducing this new perennial style of design, this naturalistic style of design, which he is a great enthusiast for. That was the most important garden in my time looking at Chelsea and being in the garden scene. And then later, just gardens which have worked, there's one by Tom Stuart Smith, I think it was in 2004, the one using great big chunks of Cortenn steel, canal-like trough, and these viburnum ritidophyllum multi-stem trees all around, and just a really rich, deep planting. And he made no attempt to make the garden look like a back garden of a house, which is the official line from Chelsea Flower Show. He just ignored that, and the more experienced designers tend to. And he created a garden that felt like a continuum or a snapshot or a distillation of a garden. So it sort of existed on a different plane rather than as a sort of a garden with boundaries in its own right, like a little tiny plot somewhere. So that was quite a sophisticated thing to do. And then a few years ago, the third one is not quite the same, but it was the one that Dan Pearson did, which is an evocation of Chatsworth. But I quite like that one more for anything than for its shape, which is a great big kind of lozenge shape with this simple, well, it wasn't simple to do, but it was a simple idea, which was really a quotation of wild nature, a bit of streamside fell really from the Chatsworth estate in Derbyshire, which he kind of beautifully recreated. But it was nice because the visitors to the show were able to approach the garden from many different angles in all of these little indentations and so on in the side. And so it was a garden that could be appreciated by visitors a great deal more easily than most show gardens. So that was nice as well. I mean, there was also a very emotional one before that, which was all about the DMZ between North Korea and South Korea, the demilitarized zone. It was a very emotional garden. I remember that one too, but not so much for the design quality, but just for the sheer raw emotion from the Korean designer who'd done it. And subsequently been in into this demilitarized zone, ostensibly to look at the plants, but I got out of there pretty quickly, I have to say.
For those of you listening at home, Tim Richardson's book, You Should Have Been Here Last Week, Sharp Cuttings from a Garden Writer. I'll read you the quote on the very front of it by Caroline Donald of the Sunday Times, and it's a collection of lively articles by one of the most intelligent garden critics writing today. Richardson is not afraid to prod, tease, and question received opinion. And it is one of the reasons why I have such a great respect for the gentleman who you've spent the last two episodes listening to. I can't but highly recommend it personally. I did read it literally in the space of one day, and it's only the second book that we have had on the Sideshow in 2018, but for very, very, very good reason. I did say at the start I couldn't and wouldn't be able to pull the wool over your eyes by giving you anything other than the best. If you're looking for I don't want to say a stocking filler, a Christmas present, but if you're looking to buy somebody who you like, not somebody who you don't like, that'd be a nice gift. They'd probably thank you for it, and then they'd call around and you'd have to spend more time with them. But if you want to get somebody who you like a gift, this is it. Go to your local bookstore and ask them to get it in for you. It is an absolutely riveting and insightful read. I should add, keep the cup of Two Spots coffee to the right hand side, far away when you are reading, and only touch it when you are taking a little bit of a break. Tim Richardson, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. It was great chatting to you, and thanks for inviting me on the show.
You're most welcome.
Thanks, Tim.
Cheers, Tim. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.